Shadowcast, episode 16. This week's story, Those Below, by Jeremy C. Shipp. Jeremy Shipp is an author of bizarro, horror, dark fantasy, and magic realism. His work has appeared or is forthcoming in over 50 publications. The likes of Cemetery Dance, Chai Zine, Harlan County Horrors, Apex Magazine, Pseudopod, and here, in Shadowcast episode number 7. His latest book, titled Cursed, has been nominated for a Bram Stoker Award. Recently, I had a chance to interview Jeremy, and the following is the result of that, experiment. Okay, I believe we have Jeremy Shipp on the line. Are you there, Jeremy?
I'm sorry, Jeremy can't come to the phone right now. He's currently battling a giant mutant rubber chicken. My pet giant mutant rubber chicken.
Okay, and you are?
My name is Conscience the Edit Clown, and I love new friends.
You know, I think I'll call Jeremy back later.
You will not hang up. You will ask me Jeremy's questions, and I will give you Jeremy's answers. I know how Jeremy would answer any question. I know his mind backwards and forwards. You see, sometimes when Jeremy's sleeping, I really like to open his skull and lick his brains.
That's disgusting.
Not really. His brains taste like marshmallow peeps. Now let's get started.
Actually, I think I'd really rather reschedule the interview and speak with Jeremy directly.
If you don't interview me, I will move into your attic and sing you lullabies of death every night.
Okay. All right, question one comes from Marilyn. Could you please explain the curse of the Jello Jiggle Jinx and what meanies cast this curse?
All right, well, first of all, I am not a meanie. Is it mean to be a clown and want to entertain people? Is it mean to eat baby manatee angels for breakfast? Is it mean to perform unnecessary surgeries on unsuspecting humans in their sleep? I think not. The Jello Jiggle Jinx is a hilarious curse that makes Jeremy laugh and laugh whenever I inflict it upon him. If you'd like to cast your own Jiggle Jinx, all you need is some seltzer water mixed with Smurf blood, a bottle of liquefied porcelain unicorns, and a frozen rainbow. Oh, and the tears of a balloon animal.
Okay. Question two from Craig Smith. Have you ever had Pinky in the Brain thoughts and contemplating using your gnome army to take over the world?
Jeremy and his pitiful gnomic army are a bunch of hippie wimpadoodles. Their greatest aspiration is to put on a musical based on Charles in Charge. On the other severed hand, me and my minions will one day control the world. And on that day, everyone will know the meaning of the word Zaltar.
What's Zaltar?
You won't know until I take over the world. Didn't I just say that? Do you need me to suck the earwax out of your ear holes?
I'd really rather you didn't. Question three from Johnny Hellstrom. How do you keep your invisible ninja cats and pet potatoes from constantly fighting over the territory in your closet when you're not looking?
Easy. First, you eat the eyes of the potatoes. Then, you transform the ninja cats into glittery horseshoes. Jeremy never listens to my advice, however, and he keeps the peace by using his Care Bear stare, which he calls the Jer-Bear stare.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Question four from Rainy Connie Lynn. Do you have garden gnomes at your home, in your garden, or in your lawn?
Well, Jeremy has gnomes in his garden, his lawn, his bathtub, his fridge, and his medicine cabinet. You know, he even rents out his appendix to a family of microscopic gnomes. But, you know, gnomes are delicious, by the way. They taste just like mold sprites.
I wouldn't know. Question five from Liam Kemp. Are you aware that your beard has bonded with your childhood nemesis and is coming for you when you least expect it?
Of course I'm aware of this, as I'm Jeremy's childhood nemesis. Jeremy's beard has a heart of gold and a body of bronze, and a brain filled with boysenberry jam. One day, the beard and I will defeat Jeremy and his gnomes, and we'll all celebrate by watching a very special episode of Blossom. That's the only way attic clowns celebrate.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, being an attic clown isn't all fun and games.
Question 6 from Lincoln Chrysler. Very simple. Pirates, robots, or ninjas?
Jeremy loves ninjas the best, but I prefer pirates. They're arguably the best tasting of the three.
That was a horrible pun.
You're a horrible pun.
Moving on. From David. What is the yard gnome's favorite sock color?
Yard gnomes don't wear socks. But they do enjoy making sock puppets out of old yellow socks that were once white. Yard gnome puppet shows are a bit too postmodern for my taste.
Okay, another one from David. Have you ever written a story in third-person point of view, and do the attic clowns need a license for their clown car?
Years ago, Jeremy would always write in third-person. He would even speak about himself in third-person. Jeremy's frightened, he would say. Please don't throw that axe at me, Jeremy would say. Then I'd laugh like this. As for whether or not we need a license for our car, of course we do. I have a car license, an evil license, an organ pickling license, and a license, which lets me keep my other licenses.
Okay, next question from Neil. Do you think you would prefer to continue writing for smaller groups of people throughout your career, playing to your niche, or would you like to one day break out and have a sort of mass appeal like Twilight or The Da Vinci Code, without being as terrible as Twilight? I mean, that's just an example.
Jeremy told me once he would love for his books to be read by large numbers of people and gnomes. After he told me that, I called him names and made him cry. His tears oddly taste like peppermint.
That is definitely odd. Another one from Neil. There's always been some talk about Bizarro reaching mainstream status. Is that something you ever really think about, or do you just do what you do and to hell with fame and fortune?
Well, you know, Jeremy would love for Bizarro fiction to get more attention. But he doesn't really care about fame or fortune. All he really cares about is supporting his family and touching the hearts and minds of his readers. What a fool. If he wants to touch people's hearts, he should do what I do and use a hacksaw.
Speaking of using a hacksaw, our next question comes from Paul Ellard Cooley. Do you consider your genre bizarro fiction?
Jeremy usually thinks of his stories as bizarro, horror, or dark fantasy. I usually think of Jeremy's stories as Sasquatch poop.
Okay. Another one from Paul. Can you describe bizarro fiction to us and why people put your stories in that category?
Bizarro fiction makes you think, and it makes you feel, makes you smile, and makes you want to eat a baby penguin drenched in barbecue sauce with fried angel wings on the side. So people must label Jeremy's stories as bizarro, because the story makes people want to eat penguins.
Okay, another one from Paul. Where on earth did your constant yard gnome fetish come from, and did you consider marrying one?
Jeremy likes gnomes because he's a giant gnome himself. And Jeremy never considered marrying a gnome because the only person he ever fell in love with was his wife. And she's a mermaid. I really avoid her because she has powerful magic. Unfortunately, she turned me into a baby penguin, so I ate myself.
That is certainly unfortunate. Question 14 comes from Chris Bozeman. What's the quickest way to a yard gnome's heart, with or without a spork?
Yard gnomes like kind, creative, funny people. Attic clowns, on the other hand, prefer hateful, anthropomorphic parsnips.
Question 15 from Denton Hillen says, I finished the book, Cursed is what he's speaking of, as did my wife, and we both like to know how you got inside my head.
Well, okay. Jeremy tends to write books that many people connect with on a personal level. I tend to write books that give people demonic paper cuts.
How much of what you write can be classified as pure fiction, and how much is based upon someone you know or your perception of reality?
Jeremy's stories are both fictional and real. The stories are like funhouse mirror reflections of his own reality. I, myself, was born from a funhouse mirror. Jeremy bought the cursed mirror from a yard sale, and he's suffered from severe buyer's remorse ever since.
I was very interested in taking your writing course, or Jeremy's writing course, this last time around, but time constraints held me back. As an aspiring writer, I'm often self-conscious about my abilities with the language, particularly the grammar and the clarity of my ideas. What practical advice do you give to your students with similar issues?
Well, Jeremy works with his students one-on-one and lets them know which of their sentences are unclear or awkward and what they can do to remedy the situation. Like Jeremy, I'm also a teacher, only I teach at the local clown college. To help my students, I transform their souls into staplers.
Okay, I'd ask how you go about doing that, but I don't really want to know. One last question. What is an attic clown's greatest fear?
Fish. Fish. Hands down, fish.
Really?
No, I just said it for the halibut.
You know, you're not very funny.
Clowns never are, Jason. Clowns never are.
And that was my interview with Jeremy Shipp. I must apologize for the audio quality. I know it was a bit lacking. With that said, I now give you Those Below by Jeremy C. Shipp, read by Paul E. Cooley, author of The Fiends Collection, Tattoo, and his current audiobook novel, Closet Treats. Check out his work at shadowpublications.com.
Those Below by Jeremy C. Shipp, read by Paul Ellard Cooley. Say you're lost in the hustle-bustle of the local farmer's market in search of some shiny biblo for your girlfriend, and you find your mother mouth-to-mouth with a man who isn't your father. In fact, he's nothing like your father. He's skinny and shaggy and short. You tell yourself that if he at least looked like your father, you could stomach the scene. Deep down, you know it's not true. And maybe that's not how it happens. Maybe you track her down. Maybe you climb the fruitless mulberry in front of their house, and that's how you cut your leg. Maybe you bought yourself some night vision goggles off of eBay. Maybe you're watching and waiting. And when you finally do see them together in their bedroom, naked, you drop a bomb of vomit onto an unsuspecting yard gnome below. You think, "Get your fucking hands off my mother!" But she's not your mother, is she? She used to be. Before she moved in here. Before she changed her name. Before the funeral. Say this was your mother, and this is your life. You'd be here too, like me. You'd hear about Porter from a friend of a friend, and you'd show up at his doorstep with $100 and a wrenching knot in your gut. Porter opens the door. "Yeah?" I open my mouth, but nothing comes out. "You're Hadley?" he says. "Yeah." "All right, come in." I follow him inside. My mind spins, but I still notice that his home is a shitty place. Every step and my feet crunch down on trash and squish on soggy carpet. Lines of duct tape patch a few holes in the wall, but most are left gaping. I stop breathing through my nose before I have time to identify the sour stench assaulting the air. He takes me to an empty room. At this point, the walls are more hole than wall. Under more relaxed circumstances, I would crack up over such irony as the tarp on the floor, but I'm more in the mood for weeping. "You brought the money?" he says. I nod and hand him the bill. He gives it back. "Not until after." "Oh." He takes another look at the money. "That's $100 bill, huh?" "Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen one before. In person, I mean." "Oh." I stuff the thing in my pocket, almost violently. "Should I get undressed?" he says and starts for his belt. "I'm not here for that." "I know, man," he grins. "Just some people like me naked when they're doing it. I don't mind either way." I consider this. "Keep your clothes." Part of me, though, wants to give the other answer. The thought makes me shudder. "Whatever floats your boat," he kneels. "Whenever you're ready." I take a step forward and then pause. Is this going to hurt you?
Fuck, man, what do you care?
I care.
You say that now. Let's see if you ask me again in 5 minutes.
Maybe I'm not your normal clientele. He sighs.
No, we don't feel much pain, so clear your fucking conscience.
Are you just telling me that, or do you mean it? He runs his hand down his face.
Look, man, you can either do this or go home. But no one ever goes home. So just face the fucking music and get on with it.
So I do. I start off by slapping him hard across the face and go from there. 5 minutes later, I'm not asking, is this hurting you? 5 minutes later, I'm straddling his chest, smashing his mangled face in with my bloody fists over and over. He's shouting, stop it! And I'm loving every second of it. Halfwind's nickname is Zippy. She likes to skip and sing about the dishes as she's washing them and write poetry with waterproof paper in the rain. She'll call me up just to tell me that she's discovered the name for those imprints left in the skin when you press it against a textured surface too long. A frittle. So when I see her sitting cross-legged on my bed, motionless, not frowning, but not smiling, I know something's wrong. I sit beside her and kiss her. What's up, Half? She doesn't look at me.
I have to tell you something.
My insides erupt. I'm afraid. I'm afraid her feelings for me were just a frittle in her heart, and now she wants to end what we have before I even have the chance to tell her I love her. Tell me, I say. I try to sound brave, but I fail.
My mom, she says. She's a remade American.
Oh, I say. I didn't know Cambry wasn't your real mom.
No, Hadley. Cambry is my real mom. She's a remade American.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry. When did this happen? I saw her last week.
No, Hadley. She was a remade since before she married my dad.
Oh.
I'm a remade, Hadley.
But I can't think of anything else to say except you don't look like one of them.
One of them?
I'm sorry, I... She looks at me now.
I should have told you before we started going out, but I liked you so much. I wanted you to get to know me first before you, you know, decided.
Oh.
I told myself that I wasn't lying to you because I never said that I was alive, but keeping this from you was deceitful, and I'm sorry. I understand if you're angry at me. I'm angry at me, too.
I'm not angry, I say, and that's true. I'd have to be feeling anything to feel angry.
I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad one, she says.
Me neither. She puts her face in the bowl of her hands and makes crying sounds. No tears come out, obviously. I almost put my arms around her, but I don't.
I can't keep living this way, Hadley, she says. I'm a remade. I'm tired of hiding it.
I want to tell her, don't worry. I want to tell her, I'll love you no matter what. But I fail. I thought Halfwind was happy before, but she tells me she wasn't. She says she was smiling on the outside and crying on the inside. Now she cries a lot. Now she's pale because she stopped wearing makeup. She's cold because she stopped wearing heated clothing. Her hair is white because she stopped dyeing it. She looks dead and says she's the happiest she's ever been. I should be happy for her. Instead, I keep thinking about how someone else used to inhabit her body. I can't look at her the same way anymore. She's used, secondhand. Impure. She says a lot of remade girls try to pass for living because they're ashamed of who they are. They buy into the whole natural is ugly paradigm. But natural isn't ugly, she says. Death isn't ugly. Whether she's right or not, I don't know. If there is a beauty in death, I don't want to see it. I hate death. I hate that my mom died of thirst in a ditch on the side of the road. People drove by, but they didn't see her. They didn't hear her. Now when Halfwind stands right in front of me, I try to look through her. When she talks to me, I try to tune out her voice. Deep down, I know she doesn't deserve this kind of treatment. I also know that Porter doesn't deserve the beatings I give him every Tuesday morning. I just don't care. Animal brains have to be illegal, I say. I say it with conviction, but I don't really know what I'm talking about. I defend the living and the systems controlled by the living, only because doing otherwise would feel like a betrayal. They're a gateway to human brains. Halfwind laughs. You really think there are hordes of remades out there feasting on the brains of the living? I don't know, I say. It could happen. Hadley, animal brains are illegal because remades eat them. They make us feel good. Have you ever eaten any? No, but that's not the point. The point is prisons are filled with remades, and most of them are there just because they've eaten animal brains. The government sells these prisoners to corporations to use for manual labor, and every living person involved makes a lot of money. Doesn't this seem wrong to you? I guess, I say. But you have to admit, violent remade crime is a big problem. If you read the statistics, you'd know that violent living crime is an even bigger problem. It only seems like a remade problem because the media publicizes remade crime a lot more often. A lot. I don't want to talk about this anymore. But we are talking about it, Hadley. It's important to me. A few days ago, Halfwind told me the story of her parents' divorce. I expected her to say that her mother lied about being a remade, and that when her father found out the truth, he left her. But that's not how it happened. Her father, Barry, knew that her mother was a remade from the very beginning. He was an activist for remade rights, and that's how they met in the first place. He loved Cambry, and he wanted to start a family with her. So they had a baby. Her name was Bronwyn. Since she was born from a remade mother, Barry and Cambry knew that at any time she could pass away and be remade with a new personality. This happened when Bronwyn was 19 years old. Barry loved Bronwyn and refused to connect with Halfwind in any meaningful way, and all the while he blamed Cambry for his daughter's death. One day he left for work and never came home again. Now this story buzzes in my head. I know that Halfwind's just looking for some living person to listen to her, to understand her, to say, "You're right, these things are very unfair." But instead I say, "I'm going to bed." This is our coffee shop, Halfwind's and mine. Neither of us drink coffee, but we enjoy the comity and the photographs of dancing mannequins on the walls. Today, I don't invite her. I've never seen a remade in here before, though I tell myself the reason I don't call her is because I need some time alone. A man and a woman at the next table converse in loud whispers. I stare at my book like I'm reading.
"I'm no racist," the woman says, "but they have no legal right to be here."
"I say send them back to where they came from," the man says. "Start paving all the cemeteries and let that be the end of it."
At least I'm not them. I don't want to get rid of the remains. I'm all for equal rights. Hell, I'm even dating one of them. I'm not a terrible person. So why do I feel like such a monster? Minutes later, I'm in my car making a call. "Porter," I say.
"Yeah,"
he says.
"Hey, man.
Do you want to hang out?"
"Hang out?"
"Yeah, we could go bowling or something."
"I hate bowling."
"Whatever you want."
"I don't know, man. I don't usually hang out with clients."
"Come on."
"All right."
15 minutes later, and I'm in a remade bar. My mind spins, but I still notice that this is a shitty place. Like it hasn't been cleaned since it opened. Maybe that's true. The waitress, who's either a living person or one of those remades who buy into the natural, is an ugly paradigm, hands me chai and gives Porter a wad of tinfoil.
"Thanks, man," he says to the girl.
She smiles and walks away. Porter unwraps the foil. "What is that?" I say.
"Brains," he says.
"I know that. I mean, what kind?"
"Human."
"Oh." I swallow.
"I'm just fucking with you, man. They're pig. Want to try some?"
"No." I'm louder than I expect.
"Calm down, man."
I try. Porter nibbles at the brains. He trembles. After a few sips of my tea, I say, "Is it really so bad being dead?"
"What do you mean?"
he says, gazing at his hands. "I mean, why do so many remades eat brains? Is it such a horrible existence?"
"No, man, being dead is cool."
"Then why do you eat brains?" His expression changes to one that I'd never seen on him before. It's one of the looks my mother used to give me when she was disappointed in me, but showed sympathy at the same time.
"Figure it out yourself, man," he says very quietly.
"Fuck you," I say, standing.
"Let go of me."
I realize my hand is squeezing his arm. My other hand, it's in a fist.
"I think you should go, man," he says.
Part of me wants to stay and beat the non-living shit out of him. I want to blame him, not just for how I'm feeling right now, but for everything. My mother's death, the state of the world, everything. Instead, I release him and say, "Yeah." So you're lost in the orange groves behind your apartment complex because you're not ready to go home again, and you find three guys dragging a tied-up young woman toward a hole in the ground with three shovels nearby. They're alive, and she's not. You tell yourself that if they were dead and she wasn't, the scene wouldn't be so disturbing because it's supposed to be the dead who do things like this. Deep down, you know that's not true. You think, "Get your fucking hands off of her!" Say all this happens, you'd be here too, like me. You'd crouch down behind the nearest trunk you can find, waiting and watching, with a wrenching knot in your gut. For a moment, I consider racing out into the clearing, bellowing and swinging my fists. But these guys, they're not like Porter. They'd fight back. They'd kill me. So I watch them bury the poor girl. I listen to her muffled screams. They dump her in the hole and start shoveling. They say things like,
"You like that dirt in your face, don't you, bitch? Fucking zombie whore."
I try to study their faces so that I can identify them later, but it's so dark, and I'm crying too much. When they finish with the dirt, they pound the backs of their shovels against the grave over and over and over. They laugh and high-five. Finally, they leave. I dive onto the ground and start digging with my bare hands. What I'm uncovering isn't just a young dead girl. From deep within myself, I pull out a truth that I've always known but never wanted to admit. Remades don't eat brains because of the pain of being dead. The real pain comes from how the living treat them, how I treat them. I pull her out of the hole. I remove the gag. She looks at me with fear in her eyes. I'm afraid she's going to scream. I'm afraid she thinks I'm one of them. But her face changes. It's one of the looks my mother used to give me after I did something bad and then made things right.
"Thank you,"
she says very quietly. I put my arm around her, and in my heart, I'm embracing Halfwind at the same time. I see her when I close my eyes. She's beautiful. I'm ready to go home.
It takes an awful lot of skill to make a zombie likable, if not lovable. Jeremy succeeded in this case, I think not because he got inside the head of the zombie, but because he got inside the head of the reader. He brought into the story all of our preconceived notions, not just about zombies, but about anyone who is different from us, and used that to make us take a hard look at ourselves. To me, this is an absolute brilliant piece of writing, and reminds me of what Orwell did with Animal Farm. Jeremy, I thank you for sending this in, and also for the interview. I also would like to thank Paul for the reading. He really did a great job on it. Be sure to stay tuned after the show for a promo of his latest work, Closet Treats. I'd also be remiss if I didn't thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible. Without your help promoting the show on Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, and also on your own personal blogs, things like this would not be possible. I will announce the winner of the autographed Eyes and Knives giveaway in next week's show. If you'd like to be entered, all you have to do is leave a review of the show on iTunes and leave a comment on the blog telling me you did so I can contact you if you win.
I guess while I have you all here and we're on the subject of eyes and knives, I owe you some sort of update. I've put the work on hold temporarily, not due to lack of interest, but simply due to lack of time. I do plan on coming back to it as time permits, but I have no timetable set for it. The book covers 7 days, and I've brought you through the first 4 thus far. If you don't want to wait, the best thing you can do is buy the book. Contact helmpublishing@gmail.com with Shadowcast as the subject heading, and Pete will gladly sign a copy for you and send it at a discounted rate. Thank you all for listening. As always, your promotion of the show is always appreciated, and if you're new to the show and you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, blog about it, or consider donating to the site to help cover server costs. Our intro and outro music today was The Cove by The Contrarian. You can find out more at thecontrarianmedia.com. This episode was produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. So copy it, share it, send it to your friends, just don't change it or try to sell it. Stay well, everyone. I'll see you next week.
Your son was exquisite.
From Paul Ellard Cooley, the author of The Fiend's Collection and Tattoo.
I see eyes, glowing yellow eyes with crimson fire for pupils. I see talons for fingers.
You have one hell of an imagination. Closet Treats, a podcast novel from The Fiend's Collection. You see things that aren't there. But how do you know they're not there? Trey Leger has suffered from psychosis as long as he can remember, but has managed to make a life for himself. But when an ice cream truck begins roaming the neighborhood, reality slides away. Closet Treats, available now from shadowpublications.com and iTunes.
We don't believe in happy endings.